Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 8, is brought to you by The Smile Direct Club, Le Tote, and ZipRecruiter. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that. Research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
In the past few years, we have learned with horror that the very kinds of evidence we thought is fail-safe, technology and science, can't always be relied on either. You see, television kind of spoiled us because, according to CSI, all we need is science. But studies have shown that labs given the same DNA evidence will end up returning different results depending on the information about the case that the lab workers were given. That's kind of crazy, right? Not really. Because at the end of the day, all evidence, scientific or technological, passes through the hands of human beings. And those human beings can understand the very same evidence completely differently. And they also have the power to alter it. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhary and I'm here with my colleagues Amelia McDonald-Perry, Justine Barron, and Marcia Chatlin.
My name is Amelia McDonald-Perry, and I'm a former blog editor and a journalist for RollingStone.com and CrimeFeed.
I'm Marcia Chatlin. I'm an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, and I'm also an Eric and Wendy Schmidt Fellow at the New America Foundation.
My name is Justine Barron. I'm a screenwriter, researcher, and columnist at the Jewish Journal.
In total, the Baltimore Police Department disclosed a little over 4.5 hours worth of CCTV surveillance footage from the morning of Freddie Gray's arrest. The footage was meant to account for the 45 minutes he spent in police custody, during which the transport van made 5 stops, starting with his pickup on Presbury Street prior to its arrival at the Western District Police Station. In addition to the few minutes of cell phone video footage shot by witnesses, the CCTV footage is the most essential information we have of what happened to Freddie that day. Watching it over and over again has allowed me to reconstruct the timeline from scratch. It was only then that I began comparing what can be seen against what has been said about the events of that day by the defendants, other officers, civilian witnesses, police officials, and prosecutors. As I've emphasized time and time again throughout my review of the footage and other evidence during the stop episodes, there are a lot of discrepancies. Much of what witnesses allege about stops 1 and 2 wasn't captured by any of the cams. The police officers who are on scene throughout that morning contradict each other as well as the footage. There is a long list of weird activity that has never been fully explained, if at all. After spending more than 100 hours just watching the footage over and over again, including frame by frame, I can honestly say it provokes more confusion than clarity, and I don't believe it can or should be entirely trusted.
In the summer of 1969, the New York Times reported that the town of Olean had completed a year-long experiment in what they called electronic crime deterrence. Olean had installed robot television cameras to monitor the goings-on of a 3-block stretch of the city's downtown. The article suggested that at one time or another, the town's entire population of 20,000 people had been captured by the 7 cameras controlled and monitored by the local police department. Unlike the other city police departments that traveled to Olean to learn more about this type of surveillance, Olean police were not too concerned about crime rates in this town at the edge of the Allegheny Mountains and nearly 6 hours from New York City. Yet the Olean Police Department appreciated being able to monitor some motorcycle riders passing through town, a panhandler, and they noticed and helped clear a traffic jam during the town's annual Farm City Days celebration. Olean Mayor said that the program was great for the town. "I consider the surveillance and the opportunity it affords to free officers for other duties merely a byproduct of the system. I look on it as a very elaborate communication system that gives us constant information not only on possible crime, but traffic conditions and fire hazards. It is a modern method of communication, and in this day of law and order, you must innovate. Besides, the company is paying for everything during this test period, and it costs us nothing." He added, "We really have no way of knowing if a crime has been prevented because the cameras are there." The Olean project was not only an early foray into police surveillance, but it also showed the possibilities of public-private partnerships in policing. The cameras and equipment were developed by Televigil Systems, and the experiment costs were paid for by a subsidiary of the Television Communications Corporation. The cameras, which were similar to the ones being used in the Vietnam War during the time, would be eventually offered to the city via a leasing agreement for $6,500 a year. An Olean resident said he wasn't sure about all of the surveillance, but was resigned to the new world coming. Quote, "You get used to just about anything. I mean, with time you get used to it." The man in the newspaper article may have overestimated his neighbor's comfort with the system. By Christmas 1969, the Times followed up with a report that Olean found the surveillance issue too much of a political football and too expensive to continue. But Michael Arnold, the system's manager, said that other cities were interested, but he declined to say which ones. In another part of New York, in the borough of Queens, also in 1969, African-American inventor Marie Van Britten Brown received news that her patent for the first home security system had been granted. Van Britten Brown and her husband Albert first devised a system in which they could use a video camera to slide across peepholes and broadcast who was knocking at their door to a television in their home. They created this device and a remote control operated door lock because they were concerned about safety in their neighborhood. Mrs. Brown wanted to feel secure at home by herself, and she was frustrated that police failed to come or did not arrive immediately to her home when they were called. Nearly 50 years after the Olean experiment and the Browns' invention became widely used by businesses and private homes, CCTV, or closed-circuit television, had become a common tool of policing. In previous episodes, you've heard my colleagues talk about CCTV cameras capturing the events, or most of the events, the day Freddie was arrested and fatally injured. Yet in order to understand how and why a spring day in Baltimore could be captured from various cameras, record various people at various angles, and serve as the basis of various claims about what happened in a single neighborhood, we have to first understand how so many cameras got to Baltimore. Baltimore's first major investment in CCTV started in 1996, when then-Mayor Kurt Schmoke assured citizens by admitting, "I know some people get nervous with Big Brother watching, but people want us to do everything to make our neighborhood safer." Safer then meant spending $58,000 on the installation of 14 cameras to surveil 16 blocks of downtown. The cameras were monitored for 16 hours daily by a police officer in a substation. Shortly after cameras began proliferating on Baltimore's light poles, the city began adopting a policy of zero tolerance under Mayor Martin O'Malley, learning from their colleagues in New York City. Zero tolerance is a nebulous term to mean policing any and everything in order to scare and discipline those who are being policed. It is the same school of thought of broken windows policing. Everything is under the purview of the police, in hopes that everyone thinks twice before breaking any rule, big or small. Loitering, selling loose cigarettes, sitting in an idling car, petty theft, homicide. That is how it's supposed to work. But in application, it encourages profiling, negative community interactions, and, as was exposed in places like Ferguson, Missouri, more opportunities to criminalize petty crimes can make municipal tickets a profitable way of funding local budgets and incentivizing police to crack down on the communities that can least afford fines and zero-tolerance-based consequences. Zero-tolerance policing in Baltimore resulted in an average of 100,000 arrests per year in a city of around 650,000 residents, more arrests than the jails could even accommodate. Zero-tolerance was already built on principles of enhanced surveillance long before Baltimore's massive CCTV system was put into place. It involved closely watching streets and corners and monitoring statistics through the emerging CompStat program. We will cover more about these systems of policing next week. It's inevitable. Every time I go to a department store, I have something in mind. A simple black dress. Or that perfect crisp white shirt. What I find is a black dress that is doing way too much, and a shirt that will be a beast to iron. Shopping can take a lot out of me, and with my busy schedule and the need to wear something that I can look professional in for teaching, dressy enough to go to receptions, and comfy enough to sit on a plane, I wish choosing clothes was simpler. That's why I'm glad I found La Tote, the fashion subscription box that sends quality, brand-name clothes and accessories to my house for a low monthly fee. La Tote spends a little time getting to know me, my style, and offers a month worth of stylish designer pieces that work with the way I live and with my busy calendar. Check it out for yourself. Go to latote.com, that's LETOTE.com, to get started for as low as $39 a month. Enter promo code undisclosed at checkout to get 50% off your first month. Once you sign up, you'll receive your completely customized tote within days, wear what you want, return everything in the mail when you're done, and repeat all month long. Again, that's latote.com, enter your code, undisclosed, and feel fabulous with fashion delivered right to your door.
London, England, 2004. Baltimore Mayor Martin O'Malley arrived on a quest to gather information to improve policing in his city. The spy capital of the world. That was what The Guardian called London around that time. No, there wasn't some underground network of real-life James Bonds. In fact, O'Malley came to tour the city's extensive closed-circuit television security system, otherwise known as the Ring of Steel, which was installed in response to bombings by the Irish Republican Army. O'Malley was one of more than 6,000 leaders from around the world to take such a tour over the years. The mayor returned to Baltimore, and with a multi-million-dollar grant from the Department of Homeland Security, quietly implemented Baltimore's initial City Watch program. Baltimore was the first city to use DHS funds for this purpose. The technology was created by DVTel, a company whose CEO was a former head of the Israeli army. Baltimore soon had one of the most advanced CCTV systems in the country. The City Watch program kicked off with 50 cameras, mostly targeting high-profile tourist areas. The cameras were operated out of a 1,200-square-foot central command center, where retired and off-duty police officers worked as monitors, communicating with cops in the field and panning and zooming into activity. O'Malley's successors, Mayors Sheila Dixon and Stephanie Rawlings Blake, continued to expand City Watch aggressively, adding hundreds of cameras, with a greater focus on what Dixon called the, quote, city's most violent neighborhoods. Additional monitoring sites were also built. As happened in other major cities, a surveillance program that emerged out of post-9/11 fears was shifted to focus on low-income neighborhoods where domestic terrorism was least likely to occur. Mayor Dixon also invested in portable, overt digital surveillance systems, which are temporary cameras that could be deployed for a short time to monitor any location. Even as the Baltimore Police Department has maintained a vacancy of more than 200 positions, it has continued to grow City Watch to around 600 cameras. BPD budgets about $1.5 billion annually for Homeland Security, which includes City Watch and the gang and cybercrime units. In In 2012, Mayor Rawlings Blake created a new database of public and private security cameras. City Watch encouraged businesses and residences to register their cameras online so that police and City Watch monitors could locate all the cameras near a suspected crime scene.
On April 20th, the Baltimore Police Department held a press conference to acknowledge Freddie Gray's death the day before. They also announced that he'd been arrested and charged for possession of a switchblade knife, which we now know to be a legal assisted opener knife, and to debut footage captured by a City Watch camera near Gilmore Homes.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that are out there. First of all, we're going to show you the closed-circuit TV that the police department has. And I want you all to listen to what I'm about to say. It is our video that has been unedited, that is raw. We are not in the business of hiding facts.
That's then Deputy Commissioner Jerry Rodriguez, and he's referring to the outcry over allegations from witnesses that police were violent with Freddie. So BPD was compelled to share a bit of CCTV footage, not because the public has a right to see it, but because they wanted to defend themselves. Noted. The footage Rodriguez showed to the audience of reporters was from Cam 1B. A reporter asked how many other cameras had caught some part of the incident that morning.
This is the only one that I am aware of that we know that we have found that has captured any of the incident. And it was very little of our CCTV cameras. I don't know the exact. We provided everything that was on there. You're going to get a copy of it. We're going to have a copy for all of you. There's approximately 600 cameras, over 600 cameras citywide. Yes, ma'am.
This, of course, is not true. And that became obvious when, just 4 days later, BPD uploaded footage from 16 different City Watch cameras to their YouTube page. Was Rodriguez misinformed? Lying? What happened between April 20th and April 24th that made BPD decide to release 16 more videos to the public? Was it the reporter asking all the questions about the other cameras in the area that BPD seemed to be pretending didn't exist?
The City Watch program set the stage for 10 years of other surveillance systems in Baltimore, including participation in Maryland's license plate reader program. In the aftermath of the Baltimore riots, reports emerged that FBI surveillance planes had been capturing images overhead to aid in riot control. This was only discovered after aviators noticed a plane's strange path. In August 2016, a Bloomberg Businessweek expose revealed ongoing aerial surveillance. Commissioner Kevin Davis had contracted with Persistent Surveillance Systems through private funding for high-tech planes with cameras that circle above Baltimore for up to 10 hours a day. By the time the program had been made public, it had recorded 300 hours of footage from 32 square miles of Baltimore. Local leadership, like the mayor and state's attorney, allegedly didn't know about this program. They endorsed it nonetheless, after the fact. In the last year, it has also come to light that BPD has long been using a program called Stingray to simulate cell phone towers and track calls without warrants. And the ACLU reported that BPD was using a program called Geofedia to monitor social media during the riots. If that weren't enough, the U.S. Army tested surveillance blimps over suburban Baltimore during 2014 and 2015. In that case, the federal government, at least, explicitly revealed that Maryland was being used as a testing ground for the military. The ACLU and other civil rights groups worry about the constitutionality of this much surveillance. Do the homeowners on City Watch Cam 2A, whose window is zoomed into for several seconds, every minute, all day, know that they are being watched that closely by our government? Mayors usually point to citizen demands for more cameras in fighting crime, but is City Watch effective?
Former Baltimore Commissioner Leonard D. Ham once said, quote, "You put a camera in a location and you have immediately a 40% decrease in crime for 6 months in that area." That statistic hasn't been backed up. Mayors Dixon and Rawling Blakes instead attributed 1,000 to 2,000 additional arrests annually to CityWatch cameras. The BPD fiscal year 2016 budget promised 1,500 additional arrests in justifying its more than $1 billion budget. That's out of 25,000 to 40,000 arrests annually. Zero tolerance policing achieved many more arrests long before the cameras were in place. Arrests alone are not usually clear indicators of crime reduction. Were these promised 1,500 arrests of a higher quality? Did they lead to more prosecutions? Were they for higher level crimes? Certainly, it must be hard to evaluate one crime reduction strategy, like cameras, among many others implemented in tangent. Most police departments haven't conducted such evaluations of their CCTV systems. In 2015, a Lincoln, Nebraska police chief did conduct an audit of his own camera system. He admitted that it had done nothing to reduce crime or add value to investigations. Over the last 10 years, various external studies of CCTV programs have been conducted, showing mixed, mostly negligible results. Two studies in 2008 in Los Angeles and San Francisco showed little to no impact on overall crime reduction. A 2011 Urban Institute study funded by the Department of Justice looked at the impact of CCTV systems in Baltimore, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. Only Baltimore showed a corresponding drop in crime. Indeed, violent crime in Baltimore had been decreasing steadily throughout most of the 2000s, only until recently. 2016 saw Baltimore's second highest number of murders on record. Many of these studies have shown some unintended consequences to CCTV systems. San Francisco, for instance, did note decreased homicides near the cameras. Unfortunately, they found homicides increased in other non-monitored locations. Some cities have cited increased gang fighting over unmonitored real estate. Several studies conducted by civil liberties groups have shown disproportionate targeting of minority groups for surveillance, not only by the location of cameras, but by human monitors zooming in on activity. There have also been examples of monitors demonstrating voyeuristic interest in female civilians and sexual acts, not to mention all of the First Amendment privacy concerns.
While they released a lot more footage than Rodriguez said existed, there simply should have been a lot more. Four other cameras within Gilmore Homes would have caught some or all of Freddie's arrest, while two other nearby cameras could have filmed part of the foot chase. But according to a report from the Mayor's Office of Information Technology, cited by the Baltimore Sun, three cameras in the area of Gray's pursuit and arrest were inoperative due to a power issue reported to the city a month before. According to Chad Marlowe, advocacy and policy counsel at the ACLU, this kind of fail rate is unacceptable.
In terms of the concept that the equipment is broken or happened to be broken, there should be policies in place that you as a citizen can see that discuss upkeep and maintenance of these technologies. One would think that every day there is a review of these cameras, very basic, I mean, from whatever area they're looking in it, to see which ones are and are not working, and they should be noted which ones aren't working, and repair orders should be put in place. And so if, in fact, that was in place and existed, there should be a record prepared in advance of the incident in question, demonstrating that these cameras were in fact broken. It should have been noticed. It should have been reported. Repair orders should have been put into place. Now, are those policies in place? I don't know, because they're secret. So 2 out of 7 broken is a 28.5% fail rate. Is that their fail rate? Like, I would be very surprised if the Baltimore Police Department allowed almost 30% of their surveillance cameras to be in a state of disrepair that they can't be used.
And then there are the cameras that we know were working that morning, but the footage was never fully disclosed, like Cam 1D and Cam 6A. A minute from Cam 1D was included in a short montage of footage uploaded by BPD, but like Cams 1A and 1C, this camera would have rotated past the arrest repeatedly, capturing at least portions of the 6 minutes Freddie was held down on Presbury Street. Cam 6A has just over 3 minutes of footage from later that morning, but it also would have captured Freddie's arrest, as well as the van's second stop at Baker and Mount, albeit from a limited angle. 30 minutes of footage from both Cam 5A and Cam 5B was released in order to account for the transport van's fifth stop at Penn North. But those cams would have also captured the minutes before Freddie's arrest, when he and his two friends, Brandon and Devante, strolled down North Avenue. In fact, Cam 5A's rotation pattern includes zooming in on the corner of North and Mount, pausing for a few seconds on the very corner where the foot chase allegedly began. Maybe Cam 5A happened to be facing away from that corner at the moment when Freddie began running and Lieutenant Rice decided to pursue him. Or maybe its timing was perfect and what it captured didn't fit with the established narrative. We have no way to know. If the public can't see the footage for themselves and the police department isn't being explicit about what footage exists, the reasons only some has been disclosed, or explaining why so many cameras from their billion-dollar CityWatch program are broken, how transparent are they being really?
You know, if you have cameras out there, surveillance equipment that can either is designed to surveil police or surveils what is going on in general, so therefore it surveils the police and the public equally.
Right.
That can only have a transparency and accountability benefit if the public, in appropriate circumstances, has the right to see it. Otherwise, what it really is it's just kind of a combination surveillance propaganda tool. And the reason I say propaganda tool is if the police are the sole determiners of what video the public gets to see, then they are going to release good videos and they are going to withhold bad ones. Obviously, a video of a police officer rescuing a cat in a tree will be cute, and that will be up in YouTube in no time.
Yeah.
But a case where the police actions are more controversial, they may decide never to release that.
The footage for Stop 4, down at Druid Hill Avenue and Dolphin Street, theoretically should have been even more abundant. But none of the footage disclosed for Stop 4 actually captured the stop itself, and no additional footage from the dozen-plus CityWatch cameras within the McCullough Homes housing project was unveiled during the officers' trials. Goodson allegedly parked the transport van for 8 minutes on Druid Hill, between Dolphin and Hoffman. By my count, that's in view of at least three of the McCullough Homes cameras. At least two others could have captured Porter's arrival, and two more cams on top of that could have also filmed the van's departure. Where is that footage? A source close to the case told us that BPD offered a vague explanation to prosecutors for the lack of footage at Stop 4. The other cameras either weren't working or didn't have the stop in its line of sight. On the latter point, fair enough. But does that mean seven cameras were broken or proved otherwise useless for one of the lengthier stops that morning? No one has ever publicly questioned how statistically unlikely this is. Officer William Porter's account of this stop was good enough proof for police, for prosecutors, and for the various defense attorneys. That, it seems, made it good enough for the local media as well. As Justine noted in an earlier episode of this podcast, BPD didn't mind us having some information in this case. They minded us having it all. So they gave out just enough information, knowing the vast majority of people either wouldn't realize or wouldn't mind that there should be more. It's that illusion of transparency again. BPD determined which videos and which time periods were relevant to the public's understanding of what happened to Freddie Gray. But can they really be trusted to make that determination in general, let alone when investigating their own?
Cities like Baltimore do not have transparency and accountability mechanisms in place to govern their use of surveillance technologies and public access to critical videos. That's what it, from the seat that I sit in, that's what it comes back to. Because the thing is that, unfortunately, I think we all understand Freddie Gray is not going to be the last Freddie Gray. In fact, he's not been the last Freddie Gray.
Yeah.
So in the exploration of the question, what happened to Freddie Gray, you stumble into the next question, which you're asking now, what should we have known about what happened to Freddie Gray? But that should also lead to the next question. If this happens again, what do we need to do to make sure that we know more about what happened to Freddie Gray?
Smile Direct Club believes you shouldn't have to pay a fortune to get a smile you love. Smile Direct Club uses proprietary, cutting-edge technology to help you avoid the inconvenience and cost of monthly office visits to your dentist or orthodontist, which cuts costs up to 70%. There's two easy ways to get started. First, you can visit one of 12 smile shops throughout the country. During your visit, a smile guide will take a 3D scan of your current smile. Or second, like me, you can get started with an at-home impression kit for only $95, with that cost cut in half with this special deal through Undisclosed. Plus, it's covered by the Smile Guarantee, so if the aligners aren't a good fit for you, you get your money back. Now, I'll say that growing up, I had a crowded mouth, I had several teeth pulled, I had braces, and my teeth had never been quite right. So I welcomed the chance to get this home impression kit. It was really easy to take the moldings of my teeth. I put them into the prepaid, prepackaged FedEx envelope, sent it back to Smile Direct, and assuming everything goes well, I'll get the aligners. And if you do too, there's two easy ways to pay. First, you can take advantage of Smile Pay. It's $250 down, plus $99 a month for 17 months. Or you can use Single Pay. It's a single payment of $1,700 with lab cost waived. And that compares with other invisible aligner brands that can cost up to $5,000 on average. And you could save even more with insurance or an FSA. And so now, Undisclosed listeners, you can save 50% off the cost of a Smile Direct Club at-home impression kit by visiting smiledirectclub.com and using the promo code Undisclosed. This offer is valid in 49 states, only exclusion being North Carolina.
Over the last 6 months or so, I've reached out to officials from CityWatch at least a dozen times, trying to arrange an interview and ideally a tour of their command center. At first, my hopes were high. I heard back within days from CityWatch's technical director, Stephen Waters, and he appeared happy to do an interview. He even tentatively scheduled a date and time to take me on a tour of the facilities. He just had to run it by his boss at the mayor's office. Well, the tour and the interview still have not happened, but neither has been outright refused either. After a number of perfectly friendly back and forths, Stefan's responses started to dwindle. My last three emails have been ignored. I guess CityWatch has officially ghosted me. But before that, when CityWatch was still dropping breadcrumbs and awaiting approval from, well, whoever, Stefan was given permission to answer a few of my fact-checking questions. This would, quote, give them an idea of what kind of things I'd be interested in discussing if a formal interview was granted. This is how transparency works in Baltimore, at least when it comes to Freddie Gray. My hopes for an interview plummeted. I did get some of my more basic questions answered, though, starting with how the program is run. Technically, CityWatch is a city program, with the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice providing ultimate decision-making and oversight. But CityWatch also has a prominent place on BPD's org chart, under the Homeland Security Division. Quote, initial oversight comes from a lieutenant and my counterpart at BPD, Stefan said. He has a sergeant and a detective that help with day-to-day operations. In addition, our CityWatch monitors are all BPD ex-police, light-duty active BPD, or active BPD. Those monitors who are not currently employed with the police department are contracted by an outside private security firm. But it's worth noting, quote, approved BPD personnel have unlimited access to CityWatch cameras and archive footage that is maintained for 28 days. According to Stefan, there is always someone monitoring the surveillance cameras 24/7, 365 days of the year. Quote, the schedule typically depends on the time and day, he said. On a Friday night, we may have 10 to 15 monitors, and on a Monday morning, we may have two. CityWatch maintains over 600 cameras, though, so how do monitors know which to focus their attention on? Quote, it's typically based on crime data. We can't say for sure, but it certainly seems possible that the BPD lieutenant in charge of running City Watch would have also been directed to focus monitoring on the North and Mount area per Marilyn Mosby's memo calling for an increased drug policing. Still, all of the police officers we've consulted with have remarked on how odd it was that Lieutenant Brian Rice joined officers Nero and Miller on their bikes to do a little proactive enforcement on a Sunday morning. We don't know how many monitors were working on April 12th, but I'd guess that Sunday is similar to Monday, with minimal staff. That means whoever was on duty would be monitoring multiple districts at once. In addition to watching the cams, monitors also listen to the police dispatch radio. That way they can switch over to manually control a camera if there's police activity in a surveilled area. But it's certainly possible they didn't hear the dispatch calls for the foot chase and arrest because they were focused on another district. According to Deputy Commissioner Rodriguez on April 20th, Cam 1A was not being monitored at the time of Freddie's arrest and was instead in pan mode, rotating in a set pattern. Quote, "The only time the video will focus on a particular location or person or corner is if the investigator or the officer at the other side of the camera physically takes control of that camera and stops it from rotating," Rodriguez explained. If the City Watch CCTV cameras were set to pan mode and no monitor ever took control, we should be able to tell. Normally, this would be as obvious as Rodriguez described. The camera would stop rotating and zoom in on whatever action was taking place. This is the primary purpose of having monitors for the cameras, after all, being able to capture even more police or criminal activity than what would be caught by the camera's standard rotation. That clearly did not happen with any of the cams released by BPD, which filmed Freddie's detention on Presbury Street. But the rotation pattern doesn't necessarily stay consistent either. Let's use Cam 1A as an example. Footage from this camera is 30 minutes long, but Freddie and the bike cops don't appear until 10 minutes have elapsed. The first four rotations indicate there's an alternating pattern for even and odd rotations. Pattern number one can be seen on the first rotation and remains consistent for every odd-numbered rotation thereafter. This rotation pattern lasts approximately 35 seconds and has Cam 1A zooming in on Bakebury Court, where Freddie is held during the arrest and the transport van eventually parks. The camera then zooms back out as it continues to rotate to the left down Presbury. When the camera reaches Fulton Street, it zooms again on the northwest corner. Pattern number two does not zoom in on Bakebury Court or Fulton Street as it rotates across Presbury Street. However, when Cam 1A turns to face south down Bruce Street towards Baker Street, it stops and zooms in on a brick wall in the distance. How long it holds there is where we start to see inconsistencies emerge. On rotations 2 and 4, Cam 1A zooms in on the brick wall and stays put while the timestamp runs for 13 seconds. But instead of zooming out and continuing to rotate, the camera does something weird. All of a sudden, the camera is all the way zoomed out again, and it's facing further left, right at the corner of the building it's attached to. The timestamp remains normal. Rotation number 5 begins, and sure enough, it matches pattern number 1. But on rotation number 6, Cam 1A doesn't exactly repeat pattern number 2. It does zoom in on the Baker Street brick wall, but only for 7 seconds instead of 13. And rather than skipping forward to the left, the footage suddenly jumps backwards to face Fulton Street again. It's almost like the footage was rewound, only the timestamp hasn't changed. Both the original version of pattern number 2 and the adapted version, which we'll call pattern 2B, last approximately 41 seconds. Cam 1A continues to alternate between pattern number 1 and pattern number 2 until the 14th rotation, when at 8:38 and 25 seconds, Cam 1A zooms in on the brick wall for 9 seconds instead of 7, before jumping back to face Fulton. After that, Cam 1A zooms in on the brick wall for longer and longer on its odd-numbered rotations. 10 seconds, then 11, then 12, and all during the same time period as Freddie's detainment. While I wouldn't say this is proof that a monitor was manually controlling Cam 1A, it's clear that the footage does not reflect a rotation pattern that could at all be considered consistent. Stranger still is what occurs at 8:53 and 40 seconds. At the same time as the camera is zooming in on the brick wall, a man in a yellow shirt happens to be walking down Baker Street. All of the sudden, he freezes. I don't mean he stops walking on his own. I mean the video stops while he is mid-stride, but the timestamp continues to run. And run. And run. After 7 long seconds, he comes to life again, finishing his step forward. Once again, the cam jumps back to face Fulton Street. The timestamp is totally unbothered by all this tomfoolery. It's not unheard of for a video's picture to freeze while, say, the audio and timestamp continues to play as normal. Computers get cranky. But usually when the picture unfreezes after one of these little hiccups, it immediately catches up and resyncs with the rest of the video. But that's not what happens on Cam 1A. The video's picture doesn't appear to be stuck because of a glitch or a slow internet connection or that godforsaken Mercury retrograde. Instead, it looks like it was frozen there on purpose. 7 seconds may not seem like a lot, but it starts to add up if similar freezing has occurred on other rotations. That's the thing. There's no way to really tell if Cam 1A is frozen when it's zoomed in on a static piece of scenery, unless something happens to be moving through the frame at the same time. Cam 1A makes 45 rotations during this 30 minutes, 22 of which involve some version of pattern number 2. 6 out of the 22 times that the camera zooms in on the brick wall, a moving object also enters the frame. There's the frozen man in yellow, but the rest, all cars, don't freeze. That still leaves 18 rotations where it is impossible, at least visually, to tell if the footage is frozen. That this happened even just once, though, calls the authenticity of the video's timestamp into question. It is clearly running independently of the footage it's associated with. This doesn't tell us whether or not Cam 1A was being manually controlled that morning, but it certainly raises the possibility that the footage could have been edited after the fact. Back in episode 4, we pointed out that the primary footage for stop 2, from Cam 2A, looked different than all the other CCTV footage that BPD had shared. Uploaded nearly a month after the batch of 16 videos was released, Cam 2A was broken into 9 parts, one video per minute-long rotation. It may have been a month and a half late and a pain in the ass to watch, but Cam 2A's footage bests all the others in one important way. Its timestamp is embedded into the footage as an overlay. It's harder to see on YouTube because it's at the bottom of the screen underneath the scroll bar, but it's actually part of the video, not a separate entity. But all the other CCTV videos are actually screen recordings of the camera footage being played in an external program made by DVTel, the security company that had provided CityWatch's cameras and software since its launch in 2005. CityWatch still uses DVTel software to record and manage video, including when it's used as evidence in a criminal case. During discovery process, CityWatch surveillance footage is usually provided to the relevant parties in its raw form, exported as either a .avi file or in DVTel's own file format, along with their proprietary player, iDVTel. Having a video in its raw form is the only way its authenticity can be validated, should that ever come into question. That's why, when we filed our massive MPIA request, we asked for the raw surveillance footage from over 30 CityWatch CCTV cameras that might have caught some of the van stops en route. That request was denied by BPD on the basis of there being an ongoing Department of Justice investigation into Freddie's death. Sadly, every single digital forensic expert I've contacted about analyzing the surveillance footage in this case either laughed at me or seemed offended that I would even ask once I explained that I only had YouTube downloads and not the original RAW files. Well, you know what? Over the last few months, we've obtained some of the surveillance footage given to the defense during discovery, as well as some of what was entered into evidence by prosecutors. Every single piece of CCTV footage is presented in the same manner as the 16 videos BPD uploaded to YouTube back in April 2015. They're screens captures, the kind anyone at home could make using a basic program like QuickTime. Each video file is essentially a recording of the recorded footage being played in DVTel's Latitude Command Center, their evidence management program, and then saved as an MP4 file. If, say, Officer Nero's attorneys had wanted to have a digital forensic expert review the CCTV footage to make sure it hadn't been tampered with in some way, they would have run into the same problem I did. Videos that have been divorced from their metadata cannot be authenticated, and no expert worth a damn will offer any sort of serious analysis without seeing the original. Period.
Okay, so imagine me at a job interview, and I'm in an office in front of a big oak desk taking questions from my possibly future boss. I've worked hard to learn about the company, I researched the website, I know the product, I feel really confident about my ability to answer any question thrown my way. I got this. First question my interviewer puts to me. So, how did you hear about us? She says. That's unexpected, but easy to answer. Well, ma'am, I used ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter? She says quizzically. Our HR department must have done that. I figured you just found us in the paper. What is this ZipRecruiter and why did you use it? Well, ma'am, I say, ZipRecruiter is an awesome website that allows a potential employer to post one job on all the top job sites. It's efficient because the employer doesn't have to post on each and every single one of the more than 200 job advertisement sites out there. In one spot, the employer can post the ad, and ZipRecruiter does the rest, including posting to social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. That's brilliant, she says. You are brilliant. You're hired. And that's basically how Rabia interviewed me for my job at Undisclosed, sort of. I took some liberties, but the framework of the tale is true, basically. Anyway, find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed.
Back at stop one, witnesses like Harold Perry, Kevin Moore, Alethea Booz, Tobias Sellers, and a dozen or so others claim that police used force when they arrested Freddie. Much of what they have said is not corroborated by the CCTV footage. That alone led many to dismiss their claims. To suggest that those abuses may have been cut from the footage is seen as a crazy conspiracy theory. But isn't the suggestion that over a dozen people have utterly fabricated their accounts when they have nothing to gain and plenty to lose also a conspiracy theory too? Still, eyewitness testimony is rarely 100% accurate. I'm reminded of the testimony that Dave Irwin gave at Adnan Syed's post-conviction relief hearing in February 2016. Most Undisclosed listeners are very familiar with Adnan's case, but the relevant information here is that Irwin, a lawyer himself, was called to give his expert opinion on witness testimony, specifically the alibi witness testimony given by Asia McLean. These two cases are very different, of course. McLean didn't witness a crime, quite the opposite, in fact, and the stakes are different. Freddie is dead, and the police officers charged in this case have been absolved of criminal responsibility. There's no changing that. But I still think some of what Irwin talked about in regards to assessing a witness's overall credibility applies. The expectation shouldn't be that a witness's memory is photographic and every detail is exactly as it occurred. Small inconsistencies actually make a witness more credible, because that's how memory really works. But maintaining the same overall story over a long period of time is important too. So are those details that provide context for the memory, like how McLean remembered that school was canceled for the next 2 days because of a snowstorm. Harold Perry remembers multiple small details about April 12th, like the fact that he was awake and channel surfing for one of his favorite Sunday preacher shows, and that his wife was still sleeping because she had been up late on the computer. Alethea Booz clearly remembers being up early that morning because she was preparing a big feast for dinner. She was standing in the kitchen cooking right in front of the window when she saw Freddie racing through the cut. Harold and Alethea don't know each other beyond living in the same neighborhood, but they both remember hearing and seeing similar things, like Officer Miller putting his knee in Freddie's neck, a detail also echoed by witnesses like Kevin Moore and Tobias Sellers. While most of the witnesses to Stop 1 didn't arrive on scene until after Freddie had been brought over to the Bakebury Court site of Gilmore Homes, Harold looked outside as soon as he heard a scuffle on the street and Freddie hollering. According to Harold, Miller and Nero dragged Freddie into the Bruce Court entrance of Gilmore Homes, restraining him belly down while part of his head was propped up on the curb of the handicap ramp. This is when Miller first got on top of Freddie and bore down with his knee near the top of his spine, according to Harold. The media published accounts from other witnesses, like Dwayne Day, about the officers roughing up Freddie by the ramp before he was taken over to Bakebury Court. Most of what Harold describes wouldn't have been in view of Cam 1A, but it should have been visible on Cam 1B.
That's the CCTV camera located on the Baker Street end of Gilmore Homes, which rotates to look up Bruce Court towards Presbury and actually zooms in on the handicap ramp. Its rotation is approximately 50 seconds long, has one pattern, zooming in on the ramp and then eastward down Baker Street. So reminder, Freddie and Miller arrive on Presbury at 8:39 and 59 seconds. Nero was seen riding down Bruce Street at 8:40 and 4 seconds, and 11 seconds after that, one of them radios dispatched to say, "We got one." Cam 1B actually zooms in on the handicap ramp at 8:40 and 9 seconds, capturing Nero just as he rolls onto Presbury Street. There's no one on the ramp, though, but remember, Miller said Freddie ran into the Bakebury Court entrance first and then doubled back out, leading Miller to drop his bike. The camera zooms back out after less than a second, but you can still see the blurry railing in the distance. This is where watching frame by frame makes all the difference. Just before 8:40 and 11 seconds, the footage freezes. You can tell by keeping your eye on Nero. Cam 1B pans down, but the picture still looks frozen. The railing is still visible until just after 8:40 and 12 seconds, when there should be movement and perhaps a flash of yellow from Miller's bike uniform. This is where Freddie is allegedly surrendering. The timestamp, though, as with Cam 1A, the clock is still running. During episode 3, I pointed out that we're supposed to believe that a ton of action went down in a very short period of time. That is especially apparent when you compare the footage from Cam 1A, B, and C against each other, assuming their timestamps are accurate and nothing fishy is going on. So, at 8:40 and 12 seconds on Cam 1B, there's still no sign of Freddie and Miller on the ramp, right? Well, 9 seconds later on Cam 1A, we see what's supposedly the moments after Freddie's been taken into custody. Nero is seen on the ramp, alone, and he's getting back on his bike to ride over to the Bakebury Court side of Gilmore Homes. So by this point, Freddie has run onto the ramp, stopped, and surrendered. Miller has put him in a prone position on the ground and then picked him back up to bring him over into the courtyard to handcuff him. And Nero has also ended up on the ramp, but without having any involvement in Freddie's detainment, getting off, and then getting back on his bike. All in under 10 seconds. That's a lot. There are other things about the footage during this time frame that bug me. On Cam 1A, as Nero rides into Bakebury Court, he appears to shapeshift into a random guy just walking down the street that wasn't there before. During the same rotation, Lieutenant Rice suddenly is seen riding up Bruce Street, but there's no sign of where he came from, like he appeared out of thin air. And then there's the white truck. We see it first on Cam 1A at 8:40 and 7 seconds, near the Fulton Street end of Presbury, driving east. On the next rotation, the truck is only as far as the ramp, and though it appears to be traveling at a decent speed, it's barely gone half a block in 14 seconds. And 7 seconds later, the truck is at the corner of Mount Street, so it took half the time to drive down the second half of the block. The white truck doesn't appear on Cam 1B at all. There is a white truck on Cam 1C, though. This is a CCTV camera on the Bakebury Court side of Gilmore Homes. Its rotation pattern lasts around 51 seconds, and it misses Freddie's arrest entirely. But at 8:40 and 32 seconds, a white truck turns right from Presbury onto Mount Street. But is it the same white truck? I sent a ton of screenshots to my friend John, who works at a men's magazine and knows everything about cars. He almost immediately determined that the truck on Cam 1A is a Chevy Silverado 1500, which was manufactured between 1996 and 2007. I googled, and the grille is a match. John thought the second white truck, based on the rear bumper, window shape, and taillights, could also be a Silverado. But he wasn't sure about the white truck on Cam 1C. Then something jumped out at me. The third truck has a ton of stuff in the cargo bed. It's messy. Truck number one, on the other hand, looks practically empty, except for some sort of box near the tailgate. We can't see truck number two nearly as well, but it still looks emptier than truck number three, by a lot. We'll post some photos to our site and you can judge for yourself. I'll just stop beating around the bush here. If truck number three is different than truck number one and truck number two, then the footage has been edited to make it appear as though all three are one and the same. And if that is the case, it was likely edited to disguise the fact that other edits had been made. And if that's what happened here, making the footage from all three cams look in sync as the white truck does, it's still just a band-aid. The timestamps would no longer be accurate on the edited video, so inconsistencies will appear again and again. Unless the seconds that were cut out could be added back in somehow, so the timestamps were accurate again. Then the footage would really be in sync. Maybe that's why Cam 1A spends so much time staring at that boring brick wall down on Baker Street. If the videos of Stop 1 have been edited, and footage of static scenery was added in order to resync the timestamps, it would help explain why the officers' accounts don't quite add up either. Cam 1A's rotation pattern, for example, is at its most inconsistent during the 6 minutes Freddie and the various officers are on Presbury Street. Porter was assigned to Sector 4, which includes Gilmore Homes. But when Lieutenant Rice called out the foot chase, Porter said he was still doing vehicle inspection down at the station. He and Officer Novak are the only officers who weren't yet out on patrol, even though their shifts started at 7 a.m. and roll call lasts about 20 minutes. Porter said in his initial statement on April 17th that he parked on Westwood and Bruce and helped canvass for the second suspect for about 8 minutes. This appears impossible based on the CCTV footage. Stop 1 lasts just over 6 minutes, and Porter doesn't arrive until 3 minutes in. And then there's Officer Novak. He claimed that he was down at the station, preparing to go get gas, when he heard Rice's call for backup on dispatch, and immediately responded. We see him arrive on cams 1A and 1C at approximately 8:41 and 11 seconds, pulling up alongside the arrest to check in with Miller and Nero. But if you watch Novak's arrival on cam 1C, you'll notice that he did not take Mount Street, as would be the most logical and direct route if he came from the station. He's actually driven west, via Presbury instead. And there's another police car behind him. We're at the stop, Novak says over dispatch. Is he using the plural because he's including the driver of the police car behind him? Or does he have another officer in his car that has never been mentioned? Cam 1A's footage makes it appear like only Novak pulled up alongside the arrest. Very briefly, in fact. The camera rotates so the car is out of frame. But at 8:41 and 21 seconds, it appears on screen again, driving to the corner of Fulton Street and turning left. But is that actually what happened? This moment on the CCTV footage immediately came to mind when I interviewed Harold Perry, and he told me about the two police cars pulling up in front of his house that morning.
Here. Right to the other side, mm-hmm. almost in the walkway, the lieutenant jumped on his back. And the boy said, get off of my legs, you're hurting my back. And he told him point blank, loudly, shut the F up. And I said, that's a damn
Did shit. That lieutenant, he was wearing a white shirt, did he have a helmet on too?
No, he had no helmet on. He jumped out of the car. He was driving the car. He jumped out of the car, ran across the street.
So he parked right here?
Yeah, he parked right here. One parked here and the other one parked behind him, almost at the corner. It was an African-American officer in the back. And he strode across the street and the lieutenant ran. You heard his keys, running across the street. I said, man, this is a damn shame.
You know, it's interesting.
Harold's memory of the sound of the keys in the officer's pocket is the kind of visceral detail that gives a witness credibility. This mysterious officer in the white shirt, I have no clue who that could be. But there are two police cars seen on Presbury Street before any other witnesses have arrived. Novak is in the first. But is that Officer Porter behind him? And is it possible that the footage showing what happened after they arrived could have been deleted? The answer is yes, it certainly is possible. But can I prove it here, in this case? No. Definitely not without the raw footage, and even then it would be difficult. Proving video evidence has been tampered with is much harder than doing the actual tampering. I fully expect that there will be those who think I am crazy to suggest such a thing. But I'm not the first to consider the possibility that the police would alter video evidence. In fact, right now, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the families of two people killed by officers with the Albuquerque Police Department are claiming just that. And they have damning allegations made by a whistleblower on their side. Reynaldo Chavez was the central records supervisor and records custodian for the Albuquerque Police Department from 2011 to 2015. He has filed a whistleblower lawsuit against the city of Albuquerque, alleging that his employment was terminated after he came forward with allegations that he was instructed to withhold information from attorneys and media outlets who filed requests under the state's Inspection of Public Records Act. He also says that he knew of others in the department who were tampering with evidence, including the 2014 to 2015 officer-involved shootings of Mary Hawks and Jeremy Robertson. The Hawks and Robertson families have filed civil rights lawsuits against the city. Chavez has signed a sworn affidavit and gave testimony under oath explaining how body camera and surveillance footage in those shootings was altered, deleted, or hidden using an online evidence management and cloud storage service called Evidence.com. Evidence.com is owned by Taser, best known for manufacturing stun guns, but in recent years they've come to dominate the market for body cameras. Footage from their body cameras automatically uploads to Evidence.com, where authorized users can assign the footage to a case along with other evidence. Taser has publicly marketed the body cameras and Evidence.com as being equally beneficial to both police and civilians. But behind closed doors, it's been clear where the company's loyalties lie. Quote, "We got into this video space to try and change this whole conversation," said Taser International CEO Rick Smith in February 2015 while giving a presentation at the California Highway Patrol headquarters in Sacramento. He was referring to the outrage over increasingly common officer-involved shootings and other allegations of misconduct and brutality. He continued, quote, "My personal bias is you guys get a ton of false complaints." I spoke to Laura Shower Ives, a partner with the Kennedy Kennedy Ives Law Firm in Albuquerque, which represents the families of Mary Hawks, Jeremy Robertson, and James Boyd, a third police shooting victim, to get her take.
To me, it's the biggest con on communities. I mean, I used to be the legal director of the ACLU, and we absolutely pushed for lapel cameras in the wake of the increase in officer-involved shootings in Albuquerque. And the hope was absolutely that they would provide accountability for officers and that it would provide, you know, some transparency into what actually happens when officers utilize force, and that we would better be able to determine whether or not the use of force was justified. And instead, it's served to, I think, greater obscure what's happened on a given occasion. You can manipulate them. There are a number of ways you can manipulate them. You can edit the videos within evidence.com. For when I request a video related to a case, I am dependent upon the department having identified the video with that case. That is input. The officers themselves put in the information and give it an evidence identification number. If they don't do that, the video can exist without an ID number, and it will automatically be deleted dependent upon the department's setting. To be able to locate a video without an identification number, to just even know that one existed from a given officer on a given night, is sort of a shot in the dark.
And that applies to not just the videos that are captured by their cameras and then input
Correct.
Into evidence.com, but also footage that can be manually uploaded from other sources, be it surveillance
Correct.
Footage or whatever. And so long as any of that footage isn't associated with a case number, it sounds like it's floating in this like sort of nebulous area where people may never know about it.
People will never know about it. When you're talking about a surveillance video, however, they can do all sorts of things to the surveillance video prior to uploading it to evidence.com. There's nothing to ensure that a surveillance video hasn't been tampered with.
Yeah.
And so somebody, you know, my understanding in talking to the computer forensic folks is that dependent upon the sophistication of people handling the videos, that there is a manner of deceiving anybody who's looking at the metadata. You can hide that information. There are some telltale signs that could be obvious, but if somebody knows what they're doing, they can obscure the fact that they have tampered with the evidence.
More than 5,000 law enforcement agencies use evidence.com, including police departments in San Diego, San Francisco, Fort Worth, Dallas, Chicago, and yes, Baltimore. In an email, Detective Jeremy Silbert from BPD's Public Information Office explained that the department signed a contract with Taser to purchase their body cameras, along with Evidence.com cloud storage, in May 2016, following a two-month pilot program in late 2015. So, post-Freddie Gray, at least officially. As of April 2017, approximately 1,500 BPD employees have Evidence.com accounts, as does the state's attorney's office, though Silbert says, quote, it cannot be characterized as full access. There are weekly training sessions conducted at BPD's Professional Development and Training Academy. Quote, roles determine each user's permissions or access and restrictions to various features and functions, Silbert wrote. None of our patrol officers have administrative privileges to Evidence.com. So what does full access to Evidence.com look like? Here's how Chavez describes some of the capabilities during his sworn deposition.
Again, it goes back to if you can upload a case on a file, if you can upload an image, then you can actually go in, you can size the image, you can go ahead and place it into an actual file. A mask is... It can be a circle, it can be a square, and again, it's like Photoshop. You can go into an actual frame, and you can mask something. So, and this is just a for example. So if the perpetrator is holding a gun, you can actually mask that where, if it's a perpetrator or an officer holding the gun, you can mask it so now you can't tell if that's a gun or he's holding a comb in his hand, so it's hard to differentiate. Same token with that square on an officer's item. You can just do the square on the entire clip and mask that, and that's where the gradients come in. So at that point, you can start making it, you know, and it's a very subtle change. You're looking at slides. You're able to view the video. It's going along pretty good, and now you start seeing a little discoloration. It's not as bright, it's darker. And usually when it's darker, that means there's a mask because there's a gradient now that's put on it.
Taser claims that any modifications made to evidence in the system will be reflected in the audit trail. In addition, the original piece of evidence always remains intact. But whether that audit trail is immediately provided when evidence is turned over is up to the department. Never mind the fact that Chavez's testimony makes it clear that it's very easy to hide when evidence, including videos, has been edited.
You upload a video clip up to evidence.com. That becomes the parent. At that time, you go in and do whatever operation you want on that original. Then it becomes the orphan. It becomes the orphan, so at the end of the operation, you still have the original, which hasn't been altered, and now you have the new orphan, which you've added, deleted, redacted, whatever operation you've done. So you store that file. You can go in at the same time, close everything up, and the one that was the parent, actually go ahead and do the deletion. Come back, make your orphan uploaded as if it were a new piece of evidence that came in that was uploaded to the cloud.
And is that how you make an orphan look like a parent?
Exactly.
Even though the Baltimore Police Department says they did not begin using Evidence.com until months after the incident with Freddie Gray, I still consider the subject relevant for a few reasons. First, Evidence.com is just one of many other private proprietary systems and software marketed to law enforcement agencies, which offer editing tools with capabilities that go well beyond standard privacy redaction. The Baltimore Police Department has had, at one time or another, contracts with many of them. While the vast majority of the time, these tools are not used with nefarious purposes, the fact is, editing video in the manner I suspect in the Freddie Gray case is not only possible, it is relatively simple, and there is little to no oversight to prevent it. Second, the situation in Albuquerque demonstrates what lengths law enforcement officials will sometimes go to in order to prevent lawsuits and negative blowback in the wake of an officer-involved injury or death. Like BPD, the Albuquerque Police Department was also investigated by the Department of Justice, which issued a findings letter saying that the department had engaged in a pattern and practice of utilizing excessive force and had a culture of aggressiveness. While people of color are far more likely to be the victims of police brutality, it's worth noting that the three Albuquerque police shooting victims I've mentioned are white. Hawks was 19 years old, suspected of stealing a car. The ballistics evidence indicates the fatal shot fired by Officer Jeremy Deere was to her neck at a downward angle. James Boyd was a mentally ill camper with a knife, and the police department sent 20 officers to deal with him. He appeared to be surrendering when he was shot to death. Jeremy Robertson was shot after he ran from two officers in plain clothes who approached him with weapons drawn. Mary Hawks, Jeremy Robertson, and James Boyd are proof that poor training, aggressive policing, and a lack of accountability can be deadly for anyone.
It is unfortunate because I think everyone's intent in pursuing lapel cameras for departments was that kind of accountability and transparency, because if these videos were actually provided to us, they would have been the best evidence of what exactly happened in any of these cases, right? Before an officer kills a citizen. And so the intent is really understandable. I was a part of pushing for this particular department to obtain lapel cameras, and I think we just didn't imagine the nefarious part of this technology. All of this stuff is sophisticated, and we don't know the level of it, but they are able to rely on that. The result is making it more difficult for a plaintiff or a civil rights plaintiff to make a determination of whether or not a use of force was lawful or not.
Right.
That's a real unfortunate and I think very unforeseen consequence of the proliferation of these cameras.
In early April, Taser made a big announcement. While the company would still market their Tasers under their original name, they were otherwise rebranding under the name Axon, and for an undetermined amount of time, would be offering free body cameras and evidence.com accounts to any police department that wanted them. Again, that's for free. I cannot help but wonder if this is the company's attempt to not only put their competitors out of business, but to get their proprietary cloud storage service with its easily abused editing capabilities into as many law enforcement agencies as possible without the usual vigorous review process. The name change further dissociates this new business initiative, which purports to be about safety and accountability, from their weaponized roots. But body cameras are not the answer, especially when the footage is in the wrong hands and can be easily manipulated.
Police have always controlled evidence, and they've always had that ability, but this is so much more complex. It makes it much more difficult for a criminal defense attorney or a civil rights attorney to identify when something has been tampered with. I mean, the effort to make that determination is so great. And it's still not perfectly clear, right?
And
there should be just truth in this. And if a department or an officer has made a mistake, or if they've behaved criminally, it should be incumbent upon the department to point that out to the officer. And my very strong feeling is that the more recent failure, certainly in the city of Albuquerque, and I think it is true nationally, of departments to have meaningful internal review and internal affairs investigations, and more of a posturing for in preparation for civil litigation, but that does a disservice to the officers. For the officers to just be adequately trained, for the department to truly monitor what is an important job, but also a job where an officer could easily get sideways without the proper direction.
They're so young.
That's staying.
Right.
Incredible.
That's what a department should do. And instead, by failing to give them direction, before and after the fact, they don't tell them when they've done wrong, and they don't tell them what doing wrong would be before they do it, they are putting these officers in compromising situations in addition to the public. It's unfair to everybody. It costs more money. If you just were doing the right thing and you only killed people when it was actually necessary, then this wouldn't arise. You wouldn't have consent decrees. You wouldn't have the kind of policing of the police that is necessary as a result of them failing to do their very basic job.
It's clear that the video footage released by the Baltimore Police Department simply doesn't add up. Things that should have been there aren't. Does it shock you that the original footage has never been fully released? It shocks us. But this is the kind of stuff that happens when the watchers aren't watched. And this is the problem with even scientific and technological evidence. We haven't found a way to keep it safe and untainted from messy, unreliable human beings. So then, it's important to turn our focus to those human beings, to understand who they are, how they operate, and why they do what they do. In this case, that's the Baltimore Police Department. Next time on Undisclosed.
A special note of gratitude goes out to Jason Henderson for his help with this podcast, in particular the CCTV analysis in this episode and our stop episodes. When Justine and I first started investigating Freddie Gray's death, we were lucky enough to be introduced to Jason, who had been tweeting about inconsistencies in the police narrative from the very beginning. He emphasized how important it was to closely review the CCTV footage as part of our investigation, gave us a leg up by sharing his notes and observations, and was an invaluable resource as we put the puzzle pieces together. We're incredibly thankful to Jason for his help with this project and for his unwavering interest in finding out the truth.
Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 8, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marsha Chatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode. Methil Telhan produced, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. Our great sponsors this week were the Smile Direct Club, Latote, and ZipRecruiter. Listeners, thanks for taking the time to listen to these adverts and for checking out the products. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins for a discussion about this week's episode. Follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag Freddie Gray and the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then.
And for his unwavering interest in finding out the truth.
Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 8, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marsha Chatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode. Methil Telhan produced, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. Our great sponsors this week were the Smile Direct Club, Latote, Stamps.com, and ZipRecruiter. Listeners, thanks for taking the time to listen to these adverts and for checking out the products. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins for a discussion about this week's episode. Follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag FreddieGray and the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then...